So I'd like to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have two oral arguments, one at 9 and another one at 10. Y'all are, of course, welcome to stick around for the 10 o'clock if you'd like. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand the lawyers have checked in, and so without any further ado, we'll call the case. Yes, you may.
Good morning, Your Honors. Steve Sanfilippo for Appellants Baker Aviation LLC and Baker Aviation Maintenance LLC. Appellants have raised several issues on appeal. I'm going to focus on the issues with respect to two of Double H's claims, and the first is the breach of fiduciary duty claim. In question number 7, the jury was asked whether Baker complied with its fiduciary duties. It was then instructed as a matter of law that a relationship of trust and confidence existed based upon the existence of an agency relationship between Baker and Double H. The source of that agency relationship, according to the court's findings of fact, was the agreement between the parties. That was the exclusive source of the agency relationship. But if you look at that agreement, of course, the central issue with respect to whether or not an agency relationship exists is the issue of control. Control over both the right to assign tasks and the manner in which those tasks are to be carried out. And if you look at the terms of the agreement, we would submit that if there was anything, it disavowed an agency relationship as a matter of law, but it certainly didn't grant the exclusive control to Double H as a matter of law. And I would point the court to a couple sections. Section 1.1 gave Baker full and exclusive possession, use, enjoyment, command, and operational control over the aircraft. Section 3.1 gave Baker control over the hiring and firing of the crew. Section 4.1 gave Baker, again, exclusive control over flights, including whether or not to take them. Section 17 gave Baker exclusive rights to market it all over the...
So can there not be a situation where a party has partial control over certain aspects of a relationship?
I think there could, but I don't think then you could say that the agreement creates an agency relationship for all purposes as a matter of law. And I don't think with respect to the issues in this case, there's anything or any indication in this agreement that there's that bit of control was given to Double H in any capacity. If you look at the briefing, the only source that they point to say that Double H had any control whatsoever is Section 6.1. But if you look at Section 6.1, number one, it applies to the situation where Double H has, or Baker has the obligation when they get a charter request to send, and Double H does retain the right or did retain the right to either say, yes, you can use the aircraft for that charter, or no, you could not. And they had 6 hours to respond. If they didn't respond within 6 hours, it was deemed that the offer was rejected. However, if they accepted it, once they gave Baker the right to use the aircraft for that charter flight, they then had no right to pull that authority back. It was now completely up to Baker whether or not that aircraft could be used. If Double H wanted to pull it back, then Baker could, at its sole discretion, agree if it found a suitable other aircraft, but it maintained control over all of that. So even that is just control over the right to make the initial decision that for a particular charter flight the aircraft could or could not be used. And of course the case law is clear that the right in and of itself to just decide when work is going to be started or stopped is not sufficient as a matter of law to create an agency relationship or to give that type of control. Here they didn't have a right to say it stopped once it started. Once they agreed that the aircraft could be used for a charter flight, they lost total control over everything. I would also point the court to Section 1.1, which states, quote unquote, notwithstanding anything in this agreement to the contrary, the parties agree and acknowledge that for the duration of the lease, Baker had full and exclusive possession, use, enjoyment, command, and operational control over the aircraft. that's about as clear as it gets. That control over that aircraft belonged to Baker and not Double H under the terms of the agreement. I would also point the court to Section 16, which, although not expressly disavowing an agency relationship, does expressly disavow that the agreement created either a partnership or a joint venture. And of course, both of those situations give rise to fiduciary relationships when they exist. The fact that they disclaimed those two is further indication that there was no intent by the parties that this arm's length agreement, which was negotiated by the parties represented by counsel, was intended to create an agency relationship between the parties. So we would say that it was error to conclude as a matter of law that an agency relationship exists. Once there is no agency relationship as a matter of law, it now becomes a question of fact. It's a question of fact for the jury to decide. And Double H didn't submit a request. They didn't object to the omission from the charge. Baker objected to submission of the question because upon the reasons that, number one, there's no fiduciary relationship as a matter of law, but number two, because it presumed agency and agency can't be presumed. Once they made that objection, that puts the burden on Double H to then request and submit a proper question. That when they don't, they waive the issue, and that's under Texas Rule Civil Procedure 279, a litany of cases. We've cited them in the briefs.
If the question of fiduciary duty is what's indicated by the terms of the agreement, where is there a fact question?
We would suggest that the fact question is because agency is not created as a matter of law under that agreement. And that portion of it was error.
So you want to put it on the shoulders of the jury to interpret that agreement to decide whether or not there's an agency relationship, or is there evidence above and beyond the agreement?
I don't think there is evidence above and beyond.
Okay. Well, if there's not, what's the jury supposed to decide?
I think the error in the first. I don't think you get there if you. The error in the first instance is it's not created as a matter of law. Then that question is. Shouldn't have been submitted the way it was, and you don't have to go any further. It's sort of a belt and suspenders argument where the natural progression is because it wasn't as a matter of law, it becomes a fact question and it's waived that way. So,
okay.
So for that reason, we would respectfully request that the court reverse the portion of the judgment awarding finding of fiduciary duty, which then wipes out, of course, the $350,000 forfeiture that the court imposed as a result of that finding. And we raised that issue as well. I'm going to stand on the briefing on the forfeiture part. I don't think we get there, but I'm going to stand on the briefing on that. And the next issue I'd like to get to is the court's disregard of the finding that Double H breached in light of the court's conclusion that prior material breach was proven as a matter of law. In other words, the jury found that Double H also breached the contract. It found that the breach was not excused, and it awarded Baker the full amount of the damages it was looking for, which was roughly $350,000. The court disregarded that finding and based upon its conclusion that as a matter of law, because the jury found in favor of Double H on its contract questions and against Baker on its affirmative defense of prior material breach, then as a matter of law, the opposite must have been established. And I would submit to the court that you can't look at this record and say, as a matter of law, which breach was the first material breach.
What's the best case for Double H? What evidence was there that you think Double H could point to that Baker Aviation materially breached first?
The best evidence for Double H that Baker breached first. I mean, if
you don't think there's any. But.
I mean, of course, you can look at this record and speculate as to what the jury could have found. If you were going to find that the first time that they claim that there was a shortage of an invoice payment, which they claim goes back, I think the first invoice was sent out in 2015. If you were going to speculate that that's what the jury found was the first invoice or the first breach and they found that was material, maybe it was that. But the problem here is, the jury wasn't submitted the question that the court in I believe it's the Mustang Pipeline case, said in these situations. It didn't mandate that you submit the request, but it's an alternative given when there's two sides of course, competing breaches, and the issue is who breached first, then you ask a question, did this party comply, did this party comply? If they both breached, then who breached first? And then that sort of solves the issue. When you don't have that, now if you're going to take away a jury finding, now you've got to be able to go and say it's proven in the record as a matter of law that one party breached before the other and therefore the other is excused. If you look at this record, we would submit to you there's no way to do that without speculating as to what the jury thought.
And you objected to this as an omitted element of their claim?
I don't know that we objected to it as an omitted element of our claim. I don't think
did
we
you
had
raise it. An objection? Is this an omitted element of the claim?
I don't think it's an omitted element of the claim. I think the jury was the judge was in its right to submit it the way he did. Again, it's the caution in the Mustang case. You don't have to solve this problem, but you can solve it by submitting the who breached first question. And if you don't, and you're left in a situation like this where one party submits multiple theories spanning multiple times, you've got to be able to conclude from the record if you're going to. In other words, this isn't a deemed finding issue because the jury found that there was no excuse. So now the only way you're going to take that finding away is if the opposite is conclusively established in the record. And I'll give you that you could probably look at this record and figure out when Double H's breach was. I think we could pinpoint that at March 20, 2016. That's the first time that there's an invoice balance that wasn't paid. Under the terms of the agreement, the invoice was dated February 29th, I think, and they had 20 days to pay it. So you can get there because the jury awarded every dollar that Baker asked for. So you can assume they found every one of those non-paid invoices was a material breach. But on the other side, you can't get to the conclusion of when, if Baker breached, that breach would, as a matter of law, would have occurred. And that problem arises from the fact that the breach of contract question was submitted under five separate theories. It was submitted in a broad form. And the damages question consisted of six elements. And let's go back. All of those elements span different times. The underpayment of charter revenues were 71 different invoices from December 7th, 2015 to June 8th, 2017. The failure to perform or properly document work, September 30, 2014 to August 3rd, 2017. Damage to the aircraft, March 2015. Failure to return equipment, assertion of an improper lien, June 17, 2017. Some of this falls before the date you could establish for Baker, some of it after, and without speculating, you can't tell what the jury decided. And that comes from the fact that the damage elements submitted for each of these alleged theories, underpayment of charter revenue, 466, amount of expenses and charges not properly performed, 223, miscellaneous charges, 354. In all, they asked for like $1.35 million in damages, and the jury awarded $247,000. You can't look at the record and say, as a matter of law, how they came to that number. And, of course, the court can't speculate as to how the jury got there either. And without the ability to be able to do that, I don't think you can look at this record and say, as a matter of law, the prior material breach defense was proven. So for that reason, we would respectfully request that that portion of the judgment be reversed and that the breach of contract award as to Baker be reinstated. And I'd like to talk real quick about the judgment against Baker Aviation Maintenance. They were found to have breached the contract and awarded $140,000 for the diminished value of the aircraft. We would assert that that claim as a matter of law is barred by the economic loss rule, which of course bars claims under a negligence theory based upon purely economic loss to the subject matter of the contract. Double H argues that the damage arises independent of the contract, but we would assert the record conclusively establishes that's not true because the damage to the aircraft was asserted as a breach of contract claim against Baker as well as a negligence claim against Baker Aviation. I think that's probably the clearest evidence that this damage arises out of the contract. The other aspect of it is the damage asked for and awarded was diminished value of the aircraft. Which again,
can we look at the answer to question number three and assume that part of that 247, 760, 264 was the 140,000 for diminished value, since that was one of the damages elements? I mean, we just don't, you're saying we just don't know.
That is among the myriad of possibilities you could look at and say, yeah, it could be there. But, I mean, again, when you look at 100-some instances of you shorted me 3,000 here, you didn't document this maintenance here, you didn't do this in 2017, you didn't probably come up with a calculator and figure out how they got it any number of ways. The problem is you can't come up there and say this is how we got it as a matter of law. So with that, unless the court has any questions, we'll stand on our briefing on everything else.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This is Jerry Bullard, here on behalf of Double H. And I want to speak a little bit about the relationship between the parties that existed before the agreement was signed. Richard Hall and his father, Lewis Hall, began the relationship with Baker Aviation by traveling on aircraft that was managed by Baker. In 2014, the Halls formed Double H for the purpose of owning an aircraft that would allow them to travel more efficiently for business. And in July of 2014, that's when the agreement that we're talking about was entered into between the parties. Now, as first-time aircraft owners,
you're not claiming that prior relationship impacted the fiduciary relationship, right?
Well, I think that was part, when you look at the case law about we have a business relationship, you could look at the previous relationship the parties had before the agreement.
But that's not what the trial court found.
That's true, Your Honor. And the basis of the fiduciary relationship, according to Judge Gallagher's ruling, was the agreement. But I want to give a little bit more background here about the relationship between these parties, because the Halls relied upon Baker as their expertise to direct them to what plane to buy and then to manage the aircraft under this particular agreement. As part of that agreement, Baker had agreed that they were going to do the accounting, they were going to keep track of charging, they were going to keep track of all the financial aspects of it, and they had an obligation under the contract. Now that also adds to this argument of a fiduciary relationship, that they had to report accurately those numbers to the Halls, and that they didn't do.
Did the Halls know about that before they made late payments on the invoices or didn't pay fully?
Well, I don't believe the record shows. I don't believe that the Halls really understood that they were being charged or not getting compensated for some of the charges that were made to those who were using the aircraft, and a lot of that does not come to light until this litigation occurs. Because when you start talking about someone who has a level of expertise and they're going to manage this contract, and we have an agreement that talks about what the rights of the parties are going to be, right, and the obligations are. But throughout this agreement, once again, we had Baker Aviation saying, we're keeping track of the charges, we're going to disclose to you what those charges are, you're going to be compensated for it, and that just didn't happen.
And that's a breach contract, though, right?
That can be breach of contract, but it also can be a breach of fiduciary relationship.
How do we decide which is which when we have a contract?
Well, you know, there are multiple causes of action alleged. We could recover under either one of them, right?
But how do we decide where the dividing line is between the duties created by the contract and then lapping over into a breach of fiduciary duty?
Well, I agree. Sometimes those can overlap.
I understand.
And so,
how do we have what boundary do we set?
Well, you can use contract. I mean, whatever the damages will be under a contract, also measure what the damages would be for breach of a fiduciary duty. But at the same time, those contractual relationships and obligations can form that duty, and you can have same damages spinning off of both of those causes of action.
It can be a difficult thing to
draw that line. I do concede that, but I think that line has been drawn here, and I think it was drawn adequately by Judge Gallagher when he issued his findings of facts and conclusions of law. Because once we started digging in, and our client started digging into what was going on during discovery, once litigation was filed, it became pretty crystal clear that they were not compensated to the tune of, I believe, around $232,000 and some change with respect to the charter fees that were charged. And this was the basis, I believe, at least in part, on the jury's finding of $247,000, because you have the $232,000, and then there's other damages that the jury could use.
Do you agree that Double H materially breached the contract in March of 2016?
Your Honor, I don't believe it was a material breach at that point in time. I mean, I guess you could say non-payment of one of the invoices, but once again, if you're not being charged everything, and you have...
But they didn't know that. I mean, I guess my question is, without the jury telling us who breached first, I mean, can somebody breach a contract and then find out later that they had not gotten what they were owed on their contract and say, aha, you know, you breached first even though I didn't know it?
I could envision a circumstance where that would happen where you would know about it or not know about it. I'm not sure I can call it a material breach for perhaps one invoice not being paid if you didn't know you weren't being charged you weren't being compensated for everything. That is a difficult line that can be drawn. I do concede that could be the case. Here, though, I think it's a little bit more clear, and I think Judge Gallagher's findings of fact, conclusions of law could do a good job of telling us exactly what happened here. But with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty, Your Honor, I believe that is a matter of law based on the facts that were presented in this case, that Judge Gallagher could find as a matter of law that a fiduciary duty existed under that agreement, but primarily because of the obligations that Baker Aviation had with respect to accounting and how they reported and whether they disclosed all the flights that were being taken. I think the number was out of 69 out of 71 flights. Our folks weren't compensated at the way that they should have been for those flights. And so, you know, that started from the get-go at the very beginning of the agreement.
Do you find any significance to, what is it, Section 16 of the agreement, where it says there's no partnership or joint venture created? Isn't that the section where Baker's employees were spelled out as being purely Baker's agents?
Well, when I take a look at that provision, I think someone could read it and say, yeah, a joint venture or joint partnership is not created, but that does not mean you cannot have an agency relationship or some sort of fiduciary relationship can arise out of that. When you continue reading that agreement about individuals who are employed by each entity, or in this case, the management team not being an agent or employee of one of the others, that means many things. One could be, well, I'm not responsible for workers' comp for those folks. I'm not responsible for paying their salaries. There's a lot of reasons why you have those provisions in there that would be separate and apart from whether or not an agency relationship could be created.
So if Baker is Double H's fiduciary as its agent, was it also obligated, because I understand that I think Baker had some other airplanes under contract, charter contract as well. I mean, if Baker's supposed to be putting Double H's interests above its own, would that have required it to, when you've got multiple planes, I mean, could it have breached a fiduciary duty if it didn't direct all the charters to Double H as opposed to choosing one of the other charter customers? I guess I'm just having a hard time understanding what the parameters of this kind of fiduciary duty would be.
Well, I don't know that a fiduciary duty would necessarily exist to charter all everything through the Double H's aircraft, but when you're doing all other accounting and you're responsible for charging what you're supposed to charge under the agreement, and you fail to do that, you fail to disclose that, to our folks' knowledge, they had no idea it was occurring until really this litigation occurred. You could have a fiduciary obligation with respect to that task under the agreement, I think, theoretically, and not have to deal with the fiduciary relationship in terms, or any other relationship, to direct all your flights to this particular aircraft.
Although, do you have a case where a party has a duty to account on the basis of a contractual duty that transforms into a fiduciary duty?
I don't have a case directly on point, Your Honor, but I do know that in an accounting situation or any sort of situation, you have an agreement with somebody who's responsible for handling money and handling funds. That's a heightened level. That's a heightened duty. This agreement talks about that duty to be reasonable in how you handle that money and how you report it. That relationship could arise out of that agreement, out of that obligation.
Can I ask you to switch gears for just one second and ask about the argument that the $140,000 damage award against BAM was was improper under the economic loss rule or because it was subsumed under the answer to question five or for any of the other reasons that the appellant raises?
Well, it arguably could be in that number. We just don't know. But we do know that the damage caused in that instance was by Baker Aviation Maintenance. It's a separate entity. So the fact that they were negligent and that resulted in that harm, our client would still be entitled to compensation for that.
Didn't the pre-purchase damage, wasn't that was released, right?
Yeah, that was the
that was released.
There was a release for that.
Okay.
Now, there was a subsequent incident.
Right, which was caused, as I understand it, by a third party.
Well, I think, if I recall correctly, I think the maintenance company had something to do with it.
Okay.
But how the plane got there, whatever the situation was, I'd have to refresh my memory on what the record says.
So what was the evidence in front of the jury? How did they come up with $140,000? Were they told anything about, you know, this was the value for the leading edge incident, and this was the diminished value for the overweighting issue? I mean, did they have any factual guidance from which to derive that number?
Well, I believe that was Mr. Hall's testimony as to what that number was.
And was there a breakdown in Mr. Hall's testimony of which incident resulted in which level of damage, or did it get that granular?
I don't recall if it was that granular or not. I would have to refresh my memory on that part of the record, Your Honor.
And did he have qualifications to render an opinion of value about the diminished value of an airplane?
I guess as a businessman who's learning what it means to own an aircraft, and if someone gives you an estimate or an idea of what that diminished value would be, then that would be evidence to support that.
He testified what it would cost to fix the floor of the aircraft, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. And there was an amount, a specific amount.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But it wasn't sold in an unrepaired condition, was it? I mean, it was fixed.
That's my understanding that was repaired. So.
And wasn't that amount around $140,000, or is that just the diminished value?
I believe that was the diminished value testimony.
Okay.
There could have been some other numbers.
Yeah.
Testimony to go into that. Okay. So, you know, with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty issue, we believe that was established as a matter of law. Whether or not the court could say, as a matter of law, this type of relationship arises out of this type of agreement, I think the evidence at trial certainly supported that finding because of the reasons that we'd already talked about in terms of what they being Baker, was obligated to do with respect to how they managed this aircraft and how they handled it. There was some testimony about the contract, talking about the management control being Baker's. Well, there's an FAA requirement for them to operate that plane.
How much did your client receive pursuant to the terms of this contract? You don't have to give me dollars and cents, but generally, how much did they?
How much?
How much did Baker pay Double H?
How much should they have
no,
received?
No, how much did they pay?
Over the course of the entire relationship.
I do not remember. I do not recall what
they did. But in other words, they get to retain those funds, and then Baker forfeits whatever it received under the contract.
But
result of this judgment?
Well, I don't believe the result of the judgment is to have any sort of double recovery, if that's where the court is going here. But there was testimony, and Judge Gallagher had said this is what you should have received under this agreement. And of course, they had already been awarded another number by the jury, that $247,000 number. So the judge did back that out. But sure, they were compensated. I'm not sure what that number was. I don't have that number off the top of my head. I apologize for not having that number. That would be a good thing for y'all to know and to hear from me. So, but now with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty deal issue, we believe that was established as a matter of law. Now, one thing I would point out is this: there's only a legal sufficiency challenge here. There's no factual sufficiency challenge, and so if there's evidence legally sufficient to support any of these findings, then affirmance is the answer, is what this court should do.
But we're presented with a question of law, what that contract means, whether it creates...
That one is, Your Honor, that would be a question of law. You are correct. What I'm talking about with respect to the jury's findings and the legal sufficiency challenges. If there's more than a scintilla of evidence to support it, then it should be affirmed. Real briefly, I think we've already talked about the material breach issue, and Justice Kerr, you've already asked me that question on that, and what I believe that material breach would have occurred. But we also believe that the forfeiture was the appropriate remedy here. I know there was a point raised as to whether or not it should have been a fee forfeiture. If there's a fiduciary obligation and it was breached, as the jury found, then the trial court did have the authority under the law to determine that the fee should have been forfeited and how much it should have been, because we had a jury determination as to what the damages were, at least with respect to the breach of contract claim. That could also be the damages for the breach of fiduciary duty, but also what Baker Aviation had made under that agreement.
Yeah. Well, do you agree, and I apologize if I'm not remembering entirely correctly, but I think that there was an argument by Baker Aviation that the damages that the jury found, that from which Judge Gallagher keyed off the forfeiture award apparently, included the monthly upkeep, storage, whatever the routine charges were from the very, very beginning of the relationship, before anybody did anything wrong, before it was put into the charter program. Am I remembering that right?
That sounds right, Your Honor.
Okay.
But at the same time, when you're talking about a forfeiture of a fee, and when you're looking at what the fiduciary should have done and didn't do,
but if it was doing nothing bad for the first year or so of a relationship, is that the sort of forfeiture of fees that's truly equitable or warranted?
Well, if you go through those ERI factors like Judge Gallagher did, and did a painstakingly thorough job of doing that, then I think all things fair game if you're going to be breaching a fiduciary duty and to be compensated for that breach. And Your Honor, I'm prepared to let the rest of my arguments stand on the brief. So, unless there's any further questions, and I'll give time back to the judge.
Okay. Thank you very much.
If I am reading Double H's chart correctly, which is A1A in the record, and I believe that's the eighth reporter's record, Double H was paid $1.285 million over the course of the relationship. Just hit a couple points. I apologize to the court if I'm jumping around just a little bit. The fiduciary relationship by prior relationship before entry of this agreement, of course, doesn't apply here. The court found as a matter of law in its findings of fact that the sole basis for the agency relationship was the agreement. That was all that Double H argued below. Those findings are in the record at 4RR 1760 indicates what Double H argued. 5 Clerk's Record 2381 is where the trial court says that it's based entirely upon the agreement, so that doesn't apply. The only way it could have arisen anyway is if there was a fiduciary relationship before they entered into that agreement. This was an arm's length contract. There was nothing prior to this agreement. Mr. Hall testified that he was referred to Baker to do business with him in an arm's length transaction, and he was a charter customer. When he wanted to buy an airplane, he approached Baker because Baker had experience, but Baker hooked him up with a broker and he bought the aircraft through a broker, and when he did, he was represented by Aviation Council out of Oklahoma. So there's nothing in this record that would show that there was a special relationship between Baker and the Halls prior to entry of the agreement.
Well, they had been a customer of Baker's.
They had been an arm's length charter customer prior to, yes. The argument that the breach was not material in March 2016, or wasn't material as a matter of law in March 2016, actually underscores our point. If you can't look and say whether or not the jury would have found whether the $16,000 shortage in March 2016 was material or not, then how can you look at it and say, for example, with respect to the charter payments, at the time March 26th, only nine of the 71 invoices on which their claim is based were at issue. Out of those 9 invoices, $186,000 had been paid. $19,000 had not been paid. So if 16 isn't material, can you look at the record and say, as a matter of law, they must have found that 19 was, or some portion of 19 was? That just underscores the issue that you can't look at this record and say, as a matter of law, which party breached first, materially breached first. The issue with accounting and whether or not the fact that they had to account, a Baker had to account, created a fiduciary duty, it did not. This isn't the scenario where Baker was collecting Double H's money. Baker leased the aircraft. This was the amount of the lease payments. Did they have to account? If sure, and Double H had the right to come and audit if they wanted to. They didn't do it, but they could have. And this is evidenced from the agreement. If you look at the agreement, section 4.47, Baker was responsible for damage if a charter customer damaged the aircraft. 8.3.1, Baker's responsible to include incidental expenses on what they're billing out if they were actually billed out. Why would, if that, they were just collecting dollars for others, why would they have that duty?
Is there a provision of the contract where they had the right to audit?
Yeah, Double H had a right to audit. They never invoked it, but they had the right to audit the records. And then the other one, I think, which is probably the biggest point, the risk of loss if a charter customer didn't pay an invoice was on Baker, section 8.2.4. Baker had to pay Double H the earlier of 5 days after it received money from its charter customers or 45 days after it's invoiced. That squarely puts the risk of loss on Baker. If it doesn't collect, it eats it. That's not a scenario where they're collecting dollars for somebody else and they're just serving a fiduciary role in representing Double H. It's their charter customers. It's their charter business. The dollars are just, that's how they quantified the lease payments. But they were Baker's dollars. With respect to BAM being a separate entity on the economic loss rule, of course, privity is not required, so it doesn't matter the fact that the damage occurred by a third party, because if it's property damage arising out of the subject matter of a contract, whether there's privity or not, it's barred by the economic loss rule. And with that, unless the court has any other questions, I would thank you and respectfully request for the relief we request in our brief.
All right, thank you very much. Gentlemen, we appreciate the oral argument. It's been very helpful. Your case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until 10 o'clock.